peaceful as could be inside the kidney bean-shaped cocoon that had formed all around her. Lila had been able to feel the shape of the infant's body by pressing her hands against the cocoon. There had been something hilariously ghastly about that. It was like testing a new mattress, gauging it for firmness. But her smile had dried up on her face when Terry started to sob. It was after 2 in the morning. That made it 20 hours deep into the crisis, give or take, and 35 hours since her last shut-eye. Lila was blitzed, and her best deputy was drunk and maudlin. Well, they were doing the best they could, weren't they? And there was still all that cat litter spread over Mountain Road. No, there's not, she corrected herself. That was months ago. Maybe a year?
There's not what?
They were outside again, moving to the cruiser parked out in front of Roger's house. Lila, cradling the cocoon, blinked at Terry. Was I talking out loud?
Yeah,
said Terry. Sorry.
This sucks so much.
He sniffled and started toward the Zolnick house. Lila asked him where he was going.
Door's open, he said, pointing. It's the middle of the night and their door is open. Need to check it out. I'll just be a sec.
Lila sat down in the passenger seat of the cruiser with the baby. It seemed like only a moment ago, but the digital readout said 2:22. She thought it read 2:11 when she had sat down. 22 and 11 were not the same numbers, but 11 plus 11 made 22, which meant... 11 tumbled through her thoughts. 11 keys, $11, 11 fingers, 11 wishes, 11 tents and 11 campgrounds, 11 beautiful women in the middle of the road waiting to get run down, 11 birds on 11 branches on 11 trees, regular trees, mind you, not imaginary trees. What was that tree? If things kept going like they were going, someone was going to hang that Evie woman from a tree. Lila could see that as clear as day, because it had started with her. Somehow or other, it had started with her and the tree. Lila could feel it like the warmth of the cocooned infant in her lap. Little baby Silver. 11 babies in 11 lima bean cocoons. Platinum, platinum, she found herself saying. The baby's stupid name was Platinum, not Silver. Silver was the name of the judge. If Lila had ever known the name of the judge's dead cat, she didn't now. Clint's daughter's name was Sheila Norcross. Of course he hadn't admitted it. What a disappointment. The worst disappointment of the whole thing, to not even admit it, that Platinum was his kid, or that Sheila was his kid. Lila's lips were dry, and she was sweating, even though it was cool in the car. The door to the Zolnick house hung open. 7. Whether Terry could have done anything for the guy or not, he wasn't sure. It never even occurred to him to try. Instead, he sat on the bed and put his hands on his knees and took a few slow, deep breaths. He needed to try to get his poor old shit together. The sleeper was on the floor. Webs covered her head and her hands, as well as her lower body. There was a pair of slacks knotted together with a pair of underwear tossed off in a corner. She was small, around 5 feet. From the pictures on the wall and on the bureau, she appeared to be in her 70s, perhaps older. Terry figured that the man who had tried to rape her must have yanked her from the bed and onto the floor in the process of removing the slacks. The rapist was on the floor, too, a few feet away. Actually, he didn't look like a full-grown man. There was a teenage leanness to him. His jeans bunched around his ankles, stopped by a pair of sneakers. Kurt M. read a magic marker label on the side of one of the sneaker soles. His face was a red slick. Breath stirred the bloody spit around his mouth. Blood continued to stream from his crotch area, adding to the swamp that had already formed in the rug. A stain colored the far wall of the room, and below, on the floor, was a wad of flesh that Terry assumed were Kurt M.'s cock and balls. Kurt M. had probably figured the woman would never notice. To a son of a bitch like this, Aurora must have arrived looking like the opportunity of a lifetime, Easter morning in rapist heaven. There were probably a lot of others like him, and boy, were they in for a nasty surprise. But how long before the word got out? If you tore the webs and tried to dip your wick, they fought back. They killed. Which seemed perfectly fair to Terry. But it was awfully easy, from there, to imagine some half-assed messiah like that batshit kinsman what's-his-name, who was always on the news pissing and moaning about his taxes, coming along with a brand new plan. He'd announced that it was in everyone's best interest to go around shooting the cocooned women in their web-wrapped heads. "They're ticking bombs," he'd say. There were men out there who'd love that idea. Terry thought of all those guys who'd been having wet dreams for years about being able to use the ridiculous arsenals they'd amassed for home defense, but would never have had the guts to pull the trigger on a person who was awake, let alone armed and pointing a gun back at them. Terry didn't believe there were millions of those guys, but he'd been a cop long enough to suspect there were thousands of them. What did that leave? Terry's wife was asleep. Could he keep her safe? What was he going to do, put her on a shelf in a cabinet, store her like a jar of preserves? And he knew his daughter had never awakened that morning. It didn't matter that the phone lines were scrambled. Diane was a college kid. She slept in whenever she could. Plus, she'd sent them her spring semester schedule, and Terry was pretty sure she didn't have morning classes on Thursdays. Was it possible that Roger, stupid Roger, had made an astute choice when he took those webs off Jessica? Roger got it over with before having to see anyone he loved shot in her sleep. I should kill myself, Terry thought. He let the idea float around. When it didn't sink, he grew alarmed and told himself not to rush into anything. He ought to get a drink, or a couple, really let himself work through it all. He thought better when he'd had a few, always had. On the floor, Kurt McLeod, the third best player on the dueling high school varsity tennis team behind Kent Daly and Eric Blass, was making hitching noises. Shane Stokes' respiration had begun. 8. Terry's request that Lila drop him off at the squeaky wheel hardly jarred her. It made as much sense as anything at this point. "What did you see in there, Terry?" He was in the passenger seat, holding the cocooned baby between wide-open, flattened palms like a hot casserole. "Some kid tried to, get with a lady in there. You know what I'm saying?"
"Yes."
"That woke her up. She was asleep again when I entered the premises. He was pretty much dead. Dead all the way now."
"Oh," said Lila.
They rolled through the dark town. The fire in the hills was red, the smoke cloud that rose from it a shade deeper than the night. A woman in a neon pink jogging suit was doing jumping jacks on a lawn. Crowds of people, predominantly women, were visible through the big windows of the Starbucks on Main Street, which was either open exceptionally late or, perhaps more likely, had been forced open by the crowd. It was 2:44 a.m. The parking lot at the rear of the squeak was more packed than Lila had ever seen it. There were trucks, sedans, motorcycles, compacts, vans. A new row of vehicles had begun on the grass embankment at the end of the lot. Lila cozied the cruiser up to the back door, which was ajar, and sending out light voices and a jukebox blare. The current song was a clattering garage band tune she'd heard a million times, but wouldn't have known the name of, even if she had been operating on a full night's rest. The singer's voice was iron dragged over asphalt. "You're gonna wake up wondering, find yourself all alone," he wailed. A barmaid had fallen asleep sitting on a milk crate beside the door. Her cowboy boots were sprawled out in a V. Terry got out of the car, put platinum on the seat, then leaned back in. Neon from a beer sign washed over the right side of his face and gave him the acid green visage of a movie corpse. He gestured at the cocooned bundle. "Maybe you should hide that baby somewhere, Chief."
"What?"
"Think about it. They'll start wiping the girls and women out soon, because they're dangerous. They wake up on the wrong side of the bed, so to speak." He straightened. "I have to get a drink. Good luck." Her deputy shut the door carefully, as if afraid he might rouse the infant. Lila watched Terry walk in through the back door of the bar. He didn't spare a glance for the woman asleep on the milk crate, the heels of her boots planted in the gravel, toes pointed up. 9. Officers Lampley and Murphy had cleared off the crap on the long table in the janitor's supply room so that Ree's body could lie in peace. Taking her to the county morgue in the middle of the night was out of the question, and St. Teresa's was still a madhouse. Tomorrow, if things settled down, one of the officers could transport her remains to Crowder's funeral home on Kruger Street. Claudia Stevenson sat at the foot of the table in a folding chair, holding an ice pack to her throat. Jeanette came in and sat in another folding chair at the head of the table.
"I just wanted someone who'd talk to me," Claudia said.
Her voice was husky, hardly more than a whisper.
"Ree was always a good listener."
"I know," said Jeanette, thinking that was true even though Ree was dead. "I'm sorry for your loss," Van said. She was in the open door, her muscular body looking slack with weariness and sorrow.
"You should have used your taser," Jeanette said,
but she couldn't muster any real accusation. She was also weary.
"There was no time," Van said.
"She was going to kill me, Jeanie."
Claudia said this in a tone of apology.
"If you want to blame anyone, blame me. I was the one who tried to get the webs off her."
She repeated,
"I only wanted someone to chat with."
At rest, Ree's uncovered face was both slack and stunned, lids low, mouth open. It was the in-between expression, between laughs, between smiles, you wore in the photograph that you threw out or deleted from your phone. Someone had scrubbed the blood from her forehead, but the bullet hole was stark and obscene. The tattered webbing hung loose around her hair, lank and wilted instead of fluttering and silken, as dead as Ree herself. The stuff had stopped growing when Ree stopped living. When Jeanette tried to picture the living Ree, all she could find that was solid was a few moments from that morning.
"I say you can't not be bothered by a square of light."
Claudia sighed or moaned or sobbed, or maybe did all three simultaneously.
"Oh, Jesus Christ," she said in her choked wheeze. "I'm so sorry."
Jeanette closed Ree's eyelids.
"That was better."
She let her finger graze a small portion of the patch of scar tissue on Ree's forehead.
"Who did that to you, Ree? I hope whoever did that hates himself and punishes himself. Or that he's dead. And it almost certainly was a he. 99%.
The girl's eyelids were paler than the rest of her sandy skin. Jeanette bent low to Ree's ear.
"I've never told anyone what I told you. Not even Dr. Norcross. Thanks for listening. Now sleep well, honey. Please sleep well."
10. The fragment of burning web rose into the air, twisting orange and black, blooming. It didn't flare. Blooming was the only word for the way it opened, the fire becoming so much bigger than the fuel. Garth Flickinger, holding the lit match that he'd used to test the trimming of web, reared back against the coffee table. His medical implements skidded across it and a few clattered to the floor. Frank, watching from near the door, lowered himself to a crouch and moved quickly toward Nana to shield her. The flame formed a swirling circle. Frank pressed his body over his daughter. In Flickinger's hand, the burning match had reached his fingertips, but he continued to hold it. Frank smelled the burning skin. In the glare of the fiery circle that hovered in midair above the living room, the doctor's elfin features appeared to separate, as if they wished, understandably, to flee. Because fire did not burn this way. Fire did not float. Fire did not make circles. The last experiment on the web was delivering a conclusive answer to the question of why, and the answer was because what was happening was not of this world and could not be treated by the medicine of this world. This realization was on Flickinger's face for anyone to read. Frank guessed it was in his own face as well. The fire collapsed into a rippling brown mass that jittered into 100 pieces. Moths spilled into the air. Moths rose to the light fixture. They fluttered to the lampshade, to the corners of the ceiling, through the entryway to the kitchen. Moths went dancing to the print of Christ walking on water on the wall and settled on the edges of the frame. A moth tumbled through the air and landed on the ground close to where Frank was draped across Nana. Flickinger was scrambling in the opposite direction on his hands and knees toward the front hall, yelling the whole way, screaming, actually, his poise shattered. Frank didn't move. He kept his eyes on one single moth. It was the color of nothing you'd notice. The moth crept forward across the floor. Frank was afraid, terrified, really, of the little creature that weighed roughly as much as a fingernail and was a living shade of mute. What would it do to him? Anything. It could do anything it wanted, as long as it didn't hurt Nana. "Don't touch her," Frank whispered. Embracing his daughter like this, he could feel her pulse and her breath. The world had a way of spinning from Frank's grasp, of making him wrong or foolish when all he wanted was to be right and good, but he wasn't a coward. He was ready to die for his little girl. "If you have to have someone, you can have me." Two spots of ink on the brown chevron of the moth's body, its eyes, saw into Frank's eyes, and from there into his head. He felt it flying around in his skull for God knew how long, touching down on his brain, dragging its pointed feet along the canals like a boy on a rock in the middle of a stream, drawing a stick through the water. And Frank huddled closer to his child. "Please take me instead." The moth darted away. 11. Claudia, she of the dynamite Badia, left. Officer Lampley had offered to give Jeanette a moment alone. Now she had the actual Ree to talk to, or what was left of her. She felt she should have told Ree these things while Ree was still alive. "What happened? I'm not sure if it was morning or afternoon or early evening, but we'd been on the nod for days. Didn't go out, ordered in. At one point, Damien burned me with a cigarette. I'm lying in bed, and we're both looking at my bare arm, and I ask, 'What are you doing?' The pain was in another room from my mind. I didn't even move my arm. Damien says, 'Making sure that you're real.' I still have the scar, size of a penny, from his pressing so hard. 'Satisfied?' I asked. 'You believe I'm real?' And he says, 'Yeah, but I hate you more for being real. If you'd let me get my knee fixed, none of this would have happened. You are one vicious bitch, and I'm finally on to you.'" Ree said, "That's pretty scary." "Yes, it was, because Damien said all that with an expression like, 'This is great news, and he's delighted to get it and pass it on.' It's like he was the host of some late-night radio talk show, playing to his crowd of insomniac nutbags. We're in the bedroom, and the curtains are drawn, and nothing's been washed in days. The power's off because we didn't pay the bill. Later, I don't know how long, I find myself sitting on the floor in Bobby's room. His bed's still there, but the other furniture, the rocker, and the bureau, they're gone. Damien sold them to a guy for a little cash. Maybe I was finally coming down. Maybe it was because of the cigarette burn. But I felt so sad, and so awful, and so, like I was turned around and in this foreign place, and there's no way home." Ree said, "I know the feeling." "The screwdriver now, the clutch head screwdriver. The guy who bought the rocker must have used it to take the base off and then forgot to take it with him. That's all I can figure. I know it wasn't our screwdriver. We didn't have any tools by then. Damien had sold them off long before the furniture. But this screwdriver is lying on the floor of Bobby's room, and I pick it up. I go to the living room, and Damien's sitting in the folding chair that's the last seat in the house. He goes, 'You here to finish the job? Well, go ahead. But you better hurry up, because if you don't get to killing me in the next few seconds here, I think I'll choke you until your stupid fucking head pops off.' Says in that same late-night host voice. And he holds up a little bottle with the last couple of pills we have, and then he gives it a shake, like for a special punchline. Ta-da. He goes, 'Right here's a good spot, plenty of meat.'
and he pulls my hand that's holding the screwdriver over to his upper thigh and puts the point against his jeans and says, "Well, now or never, Jeannie baby, now or never." Reese said, "I guess he wanted it." And he got it. I drove that bastard all the way down to the handle. Damien doesn't shout, he just gives a big exhale and goes, "Look what you did to me." And he's bleeding all over the chair and the floor, but he doesn't make a move to help himself. He says, "Fine, watch me die. Enjoy it." Reese said, "Did you?" "No, no. I huddled in the corner of the room. How long, I couldn't tell. Police said it was 12 or 14 hours. I saw the shadows change, but I didn't know how long." Damien sat there, and he talked, and he talked. Was I happy now? Had this been the plan from the beginning? Oh, and how had I rigged the ground in the park so he'd hurt his knee in the first place? What a great trick, Jeannie baby. Eventually, he stopped talking, but I can see him real clear. I can see him right this minute still. I used to dream about telling Damien I was sorry, about begging his forgiveness. In those dreams, he'd just sit in that chair, looking at me and turning blue. Too late dreams, Dr. Norcross says. Too late for sorry. Score one for the doc, right, Ree? Dead men don't accept apologies. Not once in the history of the world. Ree said, "Got that right." But oh, honey, oh, Ree, what I wouldn't give to change everything now, just this one time, because you were too good to end up like this. You didn't ever kill anyone. It should have been me, not you. Me. To this, Ree said nothing. Chapter 19. 1. Clint found Hicks's cell phone number in the address book in his desk and called it from the landline. The acting warden was disconcertingly relaxed. Maybe he'd popped a Valium or two. "A lot of the women seem to have reached a state of, I guess you'd call it acceptance, Doc." "Acceptance isn't the same as giving up," said Clint. "Put it how you want to put it, but the lights have gone out on more than half of them since you left." Hicks said this with satisfaction, noting that the officer-to-inmate ratio was once again manageable. They would still be in good shape once they lost the female officers. This was how people in power thought of human life, wasn't it? In terms of some benefits and ratios and manageability. Clint had never wanted to be in power. As a ward of the foster system, he had, mostly by grace, survived the dominion of countless domestic tyrants. He had chosen his field in clear reaction to that experience, in order to help the helpless, people like the boy he'd been, like Marcus and Jason and Shannon, and like his own mother, that pale, worried ghost of his faintest memory. Jared squeezed his father's shoulder. He had been listening. "Be advised, the paperwork is going to be unprecedented," Hicks continued. "The state does look down on shooting prison inmates." Ree Dempster was cooling in the janitor's closet, and Hicks was already thinking of the paperwork. Clint decided he had to get off the phone before he used the slang term that referred to men who had sexual congress with the woman who'd given them birth. Clint said he'd be in soon, and that was it. Jared offered to make fried bologna sandwiches. "You must be hungry." "Thank you," said Clint. "Sounds like just the right thing." The meat sizzled and popped in the pan, and his nose found the smell. It was so good, tears came to his eyes. Or maybe the tears were in his eyes already.
"I need to get me one of those."
That was what Shannon had said to him that last time, looking at the picture of little Jared. And apparently she had. Sheila, Lila had said the girl's name was. Sheila Norcross. It was flattering, really. Maybe the most flattering thing that had ever happened to him, Shannon giving her girl his last name. It was a problem now, but still. It meant that she'd loved him. Well, he had loved Shannon too, in a way.
There were things between them that other people could never understand. He remembered that New Year's Eve. With that damp in her eyes, Shan had asked him if it was all right. The music had been blaring. Everything had smelled like beer and cigarettes. He had bent down to her ear to make sure he heard her. A bite or two was all that Clint could manage. As fine as the smell was, his stomach was a hard rubber ball. He apologized to his son. "It's not the food." "Yeah," said Jared. "My appetite's not great either." He was picking at the sandwich he'd made himself. The glass door slid open with a whoosh, and Lila entered, holding a white bundle. 2. Once he'd killed his mother, Don Peters struggled to proceed. The first step was apparent: clean up. That was going to be hard to do, however, because Don had opted to murder his mother by pressing the barrel of a Remington shotgun against her web-encrusted forehead and then pulling the trigger. This had done the job with aplomb, or maybe he meant some other word, but it had created a hell of a mess, and Don was better at making messes than cleaning them up. This was a point his mother had made often. And what a mess it was. Blood, brains, and bits of web sprayed up the wall in the shape of a huge, ragged megaphone. Instead of doing something about the mess, Don sat in his lazy boy and wondered why he had made it in the first place. Was it his mother's fault that Jeanette Sorley had waved her perky little tail in his face and then tattled when he would only let her jerk him off? Was it? Or that Janice Coates had hounded him out of his job? Or that Norcross, the head-shrinking Pris, had sucker-punched him? No, his mother had nothing to do with any of that. And yet Don had driven home, seen that she was asleep, fetched his shotgun from the pickup, returned inside, and blown her dreaming brains out. Always supposing she was dreaming. Who knew? Yes, he had been rattled. Yes, he had been mistreated. Still, loath as Don was to concede it, as bad as it was to be rattled and mistreated, you shouldn't up and kill your mother. That was overreacting. Don drank a beer and cried. He didn't want to kill himself or go to jail. Seated on his mother's couch, calmer with the beer in his stomach, it occurred to Don Peters that cleaning up might not present such a problem after all. The authorities were extremely busy. Things you could not normally get away with, like arson, you could probably skate on, thanks to Aurora. Forensic analysis of crime scenes was suddenly looking like a rather secondary field. Besides, it was chicks that did all that microscope and computer shit. On TV, at least. He stacked a bundle of newspaper on the stovetop and flipped on the burner. While the paper got started, he squeezed a bottle of barbecue lighter fluid, scribbling the liquid over the drapes and the furniture, all the stuff that would go up fast. As he was driving away from the burning house, Don realized that there was something else he needed to do. This part was a lot more difficult than starting a fire, but no less important. For once in his life, Don needed to cut himself some serious slack. If it was true that Don's relationships with women had occasionally been fraught, it also had to be acknowledged that his relationship with his mother, his earliest relationship, must have been the thing that set him off on the wrong foot. Even Norcross would probably agree to that much. She had raised him on her own, and he thought she did her best. But what had his mother ever done to prepare him for the likes of Jeanette Sorley, Angel Fitzroy, or Janice Coates? Don's mother had made him grilled cheese sandwiches and baked him individual strawberry pies shaped like UFOs. She had brought him ginger ale and looked after him when he had the flu. When Don was 10, she had constructed for him a black night costume out of cardboard and strips of felt that was the envy of the entire fourth grade, the entire school. That was all lovely. But maybe his mother had been too kind. Hadn't his own go-along, get-along nature gotten him in trouble more than once? For instance, when Sorley came on to him. He had known it was wrong, and yet he had let her take advantage of him. He was weak. All men were when it came to women. And some, many even, were too generous. Yes! Generosity was a ticking bomb handed down to him by his mother, and it had exploded in her face. There was a justice to that, an incredibly cruel justice, granted, and although Don could accept it, he vowed that he would never like it. Death was a harsh punishment for generosity. The real criminals were the Janice Coates types. Death wouldn't be too harsh for Janice Coates. Instead of dosing her with the pills, he wished he'd had the chance to choke her out, or cut her throat and watch her bleed out. "I love you, Mom," he said to the cab of his pickup truck. It was as if he were testing the words to see if they'd ricochet. Don repeated the statement a couple of more times. He added, "I forgive you, Mom." Don Peters found that he didn't want to be alone with his voice. It was like it didn't sound right. "Are you sure that's true, Donnie?" his mother used to ask when he was little and she thought he might be lying. "Is it the God's honest that you only took one cookie from the jar, sweetheart?" "Yes," he'd say. "It's the God's honest." But it wasn't, and he supposed she had known it wasn't. But she let it slide, and look what it had gotten her. How did the Bible put it? Sow the wind, reap the whirlwind. 3. Because the lot of the squeaky wheel was packed, Don ended up parking at a curb down the street. On his way inside, he passed a few men standing on the sidewalk with their beer glasses, admiring the large blaze in the hills. "And there's another one. Think that's someplace in town," one of the men noted. "Probably Mom's house," Don thought. "Maybe it'll take the whole neighborhood, and who knows how many sleeping women. A few of them good, which was a shame, but the great majority either sluts or frigid. Always too hot or too cold. That was women for you." He acquired a shot and a beer at the bar and found a seat at the end of a long table with Deputy Terry Coombs and a black guy whose face he recognized from previous evenings at the Squeak, but whose name he couldn't recall. Don gave a moment's consideration to the question of whether Terry might have heard about the doings at the prison, the false accusation and frame-up and so on. But if Coombs had heard, he was in no condition or mood to do anything about it. The deputy looked half asleep with a three-quarters empty pitcher on the table in front of him.
"You boys mind if I join you?"
Don had to yell to be heard over the commotion in the bar. The other two shook their heads. Big enough to handle 100, the barroom at 3 a.m. was handling at least that many. Although there were a few women, most of the crowd was male. Under the current circumstances, it seemed that not many women were looking to imbibe depressants. Incongruously, there were also a few teenagers lurking around, dazed expressions on their flushed faces. Don felt sorry for them, but the mama's boys of the world were going to have to grow up fast now.
"Hell of a day," Don said.
He felt better now that he was with men. The black guy murmured an agreement. He was tall, lots of shoulder, 40 or so, sitting ramrod straight.
"I'm just trying to decide whether or not to kill myself," Terry said.
Don chuckled. Coombs had a hell of a deadpan.
"Did you see the Secret Service putting their boots in the asses of those rioters outside the White House? Must have been like Christmas for those guys.
And Jesus, look at that." Terry and the black guy turned their gazes to one of the televisions on the wall. It was security footage from an underground garage. A woman, age and race rendered indeterminate by the placement of the camera and the grain of the footage, though clearly dressed in the uniform of a parking garage attendant, was atop a man in a business suit. She appeared to be stabbing him in the face with something. Black liquid pooled on the pavement, and bright white strands hung from her face. The TV news never would have shown something like that before today, but it seemed that Aurora had put standards and practices, that was what they called it, right, out of business.
"Must have woke her up for his keys or something, huh?"
Don mused.
"This stuff, it's like the ultimate PMS, am I right?"
The two men made no response. The television feed cut to the anchor's desk. It was empty. George Alderson, the old dude that Don had watched earlier, had disappeared. A younger guy, wearing a sweatshirt and headphones, poked his head into the frame and made a sharp get-out-of-here gesture. The feed flipped to an advertisement for a sitcom.
"That was unprofessional," said Don.
Terry drank directly from his pitcher of beer. Foam ran down his chin. 4. Sleeper storage. This wasn't Lila's only consideration this early Friday morning, but it was right up there. The ideal spot would be a basement or a tunnel with a concealed entrance. A tapped-out mineshaft could serve well. Their area certainly had a healthy supply of those, but there was no time to find one, no time to set it up. So what did that leave? It left people's homes. But if groups of vigilantes, of crazies, whoever, did start to go around killing the sleeping women, homes were the first place they'd check. Where's your wife? Where's your daughter? It's for your own safety, for everyone's safety. You wouldn't leave dynamite lying around your house, would you? What if there were houses that no one lived in, though? Houses that had never had a single occupant? There were plenty of houses like that just up the street, the other half of the development on Tremaine Street, the ones that had gone unsold. It was the best option that Lila could think of. Once she had explained it to her son and her husband, Lila was drained. She felt ill and scraped, like a flu was coming on her. Hadn't a stoner she'd arrested once for breaking and entering warned her about this? About the pain of drugs wearing off? Anything, any risk to avoid the come down, he'd said. The come down is ruination. Death to your happy. Clint and Jared didn't say anything immediately. The three of them were standing in the living room. Is that a baby? Jared finally asked. She handed the cocoon to him. Yes, Roger Elway's daughter. Her son pulled the baby close. This could probably get worse, he said, but I don't know how. Lila reached up and traced the hair at Jared's temple. The difference between the way Terry had held the baby, like it might explode or shatter, and the way Jared held it made her heart pick up speed. Her son hadn't given up. He was still trying to be human. Clint shut the sliding glass door, closing off the smell of smoke. I want to say you're being paranoid about hiding sleepers, or storing them, to use your word, but you might be onto something. We could bring Molly and the baby and Mrs. Ransom and whoever else we find over to one of the empties. There's a demo house at the top of the hill, Jared said. It's actually furnished. And in response to his mother's reflexive glance, chill, I didn't go in, just look through the living room window. Clint said, I hope it's an unnecessary precaution, but better safe than sorry. She nodded. I think so, because you're going to have to put me in one of those houses eventually, too. You know that, don't you? Lila didn't say it to shock him or to hurt him. It was just a fact that had to be stated, and she was too tired to gild the lily. 5. The man seated on the toilet in the women's bathroom stall at the Squeaky Wheel was a wall-eyed character in a rock t-shirt and dress trousers. He gawked at Michaela. Well, look on the bright side. At least his pants were up. Dude, she said, this is the ladies. Another few days and it'll be all yours for eternity. For now, though, out. Widespread panic, his t-shirt read, of course. I'm sorry, I only need a second. He gestured at a little clutch in his lap. I was about to smoke some rocks and it was too crowded in the men's room. He grimaced. And the men's room smells like shit. Big shit. That's unpleasant. Please, if you can be a little patient, I'd appreciate it. His voice dropped. I saw some magic earlier tonight. Not Disney magic. Bad magic. I'm pretty steady as a rule, but it kind of freaked me out. Michaela took her hand from her purse where she had been holding Ursula's pistol. Bad magic, huh? That does sound unsettling. I just drove all the way from D.C. to find out that my mother's already asleep. What's your name? Garth. I'm sorry for your loss. Thanks, she said. My mother was a pain in the ass, but there was a lot to like about her. Can I have some of your crack? It's not crack, it's meth. Garth unfastened his clutch and took out a pipe and handed it to her. But you can certainly have some if you'd like. Next, he fished out a ziplock of rocks. You look just like the girl from the news, you know? Michaela smiled. People are always telling me that. 6. The catastrophic state of the Squeaky Wheel's men's room had likewise driven Frank Geary out to the edge of the parking lot to empty his bladder. In the aftermath of what they had seen, moths born out of fire, it seemed stupid to do anything except go to a bar and drink. With his own eyes, he had witnessed something that could not be accounted for. There was another side to the world. There was a deeper stratum that had been wholly invisible until that morning. It hadn't shown itself as proof of Elaine's god, though. The moths had grown from the fire, and fire was what was supposed to be waiting at the other end of the spiritual spectrum. Brush crunched a few yards off.
That bathroom is a fucking hellhole.
The man's slur trailed off. Frank discerned a narrow shape wearing a cowboy hat. Frank zipped up and turned to head back to the bar. He didn't know what else to do. He'd left Nana and Elaine at home, laid out on beach towels in the basement with the door locked. The man's voice stopped him.
Want to hear something crazy? My buddy's wife, Millie, she works up at the prison, and she says they got a, what, some kind of phenom up there. Probably bullshit, that's my opinion, but...
The man's urine spattered in the brush.
She says this honey, when she sleeps, nothing happens. Wakes up again.
Frank stopped. What? The man was twisting back and forth in a deliberate fashion, amusing himself by spilling his piss around as widely as possible.
Sleeps and wakes up like normal. Wakes up fine, so my buddy's wife says.
A cloud shifted in the sky, and moonlight disclosed the distinct profile of that noted dog-beater, Fritz Mischaum. The pubic scrag of hillbilly beard and the deeply sunken area beneath the right cheekbone, where Frank had used the rifle butt to permanently alter the contours of the man's face, were both clearly visible.
Who's that I'm speaking with?
Fritz was squinting ferociously.
That you, Kronsky? How's that 45 working out for you, Johnny Lee? Fine gun, innit? No, that's not Kronsky. Christ, I'm not seeing double, I'm seeing fucking triple.
She wakes up? Asked Frank. This inmate at the prison wakes up? No cocoon?
That's what I heard, but take it as you will. Say, I know you, mister.
Frank headed back to the bar without answering. He didn't have time for Mischaum. It was this woman he was thinking of. This inmate who could sleep and wake up like normal. 7. When Frank rejoined Terry and Don Peters, followed by Garth Flickinger, who came strutting back from the women's room like a new man, his drinking companions had turned around on the bench of their long table. A man in jeans, a blue chambray work shirt, and a case gimme cap was on his feet and holding forth, gesturing with a half-full pitcher of beer, and those around him had grown silent, listening respectfully. He looked familiar, a local farmer or maybe a long-haul trucker, his cheeks speckled with beard and his teeth discolored from Red Man, but he had a preacher's self-assured delivery, his voice rising and falling in cadences that begged for return cries of praise Jesus. Sitting next to him was a man Frank definitely recognized, having helped him select a dog from the shelter when his old one died. Howland, that was his name, teacher from the community college over in Maylock. Howland was looking up at the sermonizer with an expression of wry amusement.
We should have seen this coming, the trucker preacher proclaimed. The women flew too high, like that fellow with the wax wings, and their wings melted.
Icarus, Howland said. He wore a baggy old barn jacket with patches on the elbows. His specs stuck up out of the breast pocket.
Icarus, that is correct. That is a big 10-4. Want to know how far the fair sex has come? Look back 100 years. They couldn't vote. Skirts down to their ankles. They didn't have no birth control, and if they got abortion, they went down some back alley to get it. And if they got caught, they went to jail for murder. Now they can get it done any time and place they want. Thanks to Planned fucking Parenthood, abortion's easier than getting a bucket of chicken from KFC and costs about the same. They can run for president. They join the SEALs and the Rangers. They can marry their lesbo buddies. If that ain't terroristic, I don't know what is.
There was a rumble of agreement. Frank didn't join in. He didn't believe his problems with Elaine had anything whatsoever to do with abortion or lesbians.
All in just 100 years.
The trucker preacher lowered his voice. He could do that and still be heard because someone had pulled the plug on the jukebox, killing Travis Tritt in a dying gurgle.
They ain't just pulled even like they said they wanted. They done pulled ahead. Do you want to know what proves it?
Now, Frank had to admit, the man was getting closer to something. Elaine could never cut him any slack. It was always her way, her call. To find himself warming to this bumpkin's homily gave Frank a sick feeling, but he couldn't deny it. Nor was he alone. The whole barroom congregation was listening closely, their mouths agape. Except for Howland, who was grinning like a guy watching a monkey do a dance on a street corner.
They can dress like men. That's what proves it. 100 years ago, a woman wouldn't have been caught dead in pants unless she was riding a horse, and now they wear 'em everywhere.
What you got against long legs in tight pants, asshole? A woman called, and there was general laughter.
Nothing, the trucker preacher shot back. But do you think a man, a natural man, not one of those New York trannies, would be caught dead on the streets of Dueling in a dress?
No, they'd be called crazy. They'd be laughed at. But the women, now they get to have it both ways. They forgot what the Bible says about how a woman should follow her husband in all things, and sew and cook and have the kiddies and not be out in public wearing hot pants. Get even with men. They might have been left alone, but that wasn't enough. They had to get ahead. Had to make us second best. They flew too close to the sun, and God put them to sleep.
He blinked and rubbed a hand over his beard, scratchy face, seeming to realize where he was and what he was doing, spewing his private thoughts to a barroom filled with staring people.
I can't rest, he said, and abruptly sat down.
Thank you, Mr. Carson Struthers from RFD2.
That was Pudge Marone, bartender and owner of the Squeak, hollering out from behind his bar.
Our own local celebrity, folks. Country strong Struthers. Watch out for the right hook. Carson's my ex-brother-in-law.
Pudge was a would-be comedian with saggy Rodney Dangerfield cheeks. Not all that funny, but he gave a fair pour.
That was some real food for thought, Carson. I look forward to discussing all this with my sister at Thanksgiving dinner.
There was more laughter at that. Before the general conversation could start up again, or before someone could plug in the juke and reanimate Mr. Tritt, Howland stood up, holding a hand in the air.
History professor, Frank suddenly remembered. That's what he said he was.
Said he was going to name his new dog Tacitus after his favorite Roman historian. Frank had thought it was a lot of name for a Bichon Frise.
My friends, the professor said in rolling tones, with all that has happened today, it is easy to understand why we haven't yet thought of tomorrow and all the tomorrows to come. Let us put morals and morality and hot pants aside for a moment and consider the practicalities.
He patted Carson Country Strong Struthers's burly shoulder.
This gentleman has a point. Women have indeed surpassed men in certain aspects, at least in Western society, and I submit that they have done so in ways rather more important than their freedom to shop at Walmart ungirdled and with their hair in rollers. Suppose this, let's call it a plague, for want of a better word, suppose this plague had gone the other way, and it was the men falling asleep and not waking up.
Utter silence in the squeaky wheel. Every eye trained on Howland, who seemed to enjoy the attention. His delivery was not that of a backwoods Bible thumper, but it was still mesmerizing, unhesitating, and practiced.
The women could restart the human race, could they not?
Of course they could.
There are millions of sperm donations, frozen babies in waiting, stored in facilities all across this great country of ours. Tens and tens of millions across the world. The result would be babies of both sexes.
Assuming the new male babies didn't also grow cocoons as soon as they stopped crying and fell asleep for the first time, a very pretty young woman said. She had appeared alongside Flickinger. It occurred to Frank that the trucker, preacher, ex-boxer had missed one thing in his oration. Women just naturally looked better than men. More finished, somehow.
Yes, Howland agreed. But even if that were the case, women could continue to reproduce for generations, possibly until Aurora ran its course. Can men do that? Gentlemen, where will the human race be in 50 years if the women don't wake up? Where will it be in 100? Now the silence was broken by a man who began to bawl in great noisy blabbers. Howland ignored him. But perhaps the question of future generations is moot. He raised a finger. History suggests an extremely uncomfortable idea about human nature, my friends, one that may explain why, as this gentleman here has so passionately elucidated, women have got ahead. The idea, baldly stated, is this. Women are sane, but men are mad.
Bullshit, someone called. Fucking bullshit.
Howland was not deterred. He actually smiled. Is it? Who makes up your motorcycle gangs? Men. Who comprises the gangs that have turned neighborhoods in Chicago and Detroit into free fire zones? Boys. Who are the ones in power who start the wars, and who are the ones who, with the exception of a few female helicopter pilots and such, fight those wars? Men. Oh, and who suffers as collateral damage? Women and children, mostly.
Yeah, and who shakes their asses, egging them on? Don Peters shouted. His face was red. Veins were standing out on the sides of his neck. Who's pulling the motherfucking strings, Mr. Egghead, smart boy?
There was a spatter of applause. Michaela rolled her eyes and was about to speak. Full of meth, blood pressure redlining, she felt like she could go on for perhaps 6 hours, the length of a Puritan sermon. But before she could start, Howland was off again. Thoughtfully put, sir, the contribution of a true intellectual, and a belief that many men advance, usually ones with a certain sense of inferiority when it comes to the fairer se- Don started to rise.
Who are you calling inferior, jackwad?
Frank pulled him down, wanting to keep this one close. If Fritz Mischaum had really gotten hold of something, he needed to talk to Don Peters about it, because he was pretty sure Don worked at the prison.
Let me go, Don snarled.
Frank slid his hand up to Don's armpit and squeezed. You need to calm down. Don grimaced, but didn't say anything more.
Here is an interesting fact, Howland continued. During the second half of the 19th century, most deep mining operations, including those right here in Appalachia, employed workers called coolies. No, not Chinese peons. These were young men, sometimes boys as young as 12, whose job it was to stand next to machinery that had a tendency to overheat. The coolies had a barrel of water, or a pipe if there was a spring nearby. Their task was to pour water over the belts and pistons to keep them cool, hence the name coolies. I would submit that women have historically served the same function, restraining men, at least when possible, from their very worst, most abhorrent acts.
He looked around at his audience. The smile had left his face.
But now it seems the coolies are gone, or going. How long before men, soon to be the only sex, fall on each other with their guns and bombs and nuclear weapons? How long before the machine overheats and explodes?
Frank had heard enough. It wasn't the future of the entire human race he cared about. If it could be saved, that would be a side effect. What he cared about was Nana. He wanted to kiss her sweet face and to apologize for stretching her favorite shirt, tell her he would never do it again. He could not do those things unless she was awake.
Come on, he said to Don. Outside. I want to talk to you.
About what?
Frank leaned close to Peters's ear.
Is there really a woman at the prison who can sleep without grown webs and then wake up?
Don craned around to look at Frank.
Hey, you're the town dog catcher, aren't you?
That's right. Frank let the dog catcher bullshit slide. And you're Don who works at the prison.
Yeah, said Don. That's me. So let's talk.
8. Clint and Lila had gone out to the back porch, the overhead light turning them into actors on a stage. They were looking toward the pool where Anton Dubček had been skimming for dead bugs less than 24 hours earlier. Clint wondered idly where Anton was now. Sleeping, likely as not, dreaming of willing young women rather than preparing for an unpleasant conversation with his wife. If so, Clint envied him.
Tell me about Sheila Norcross, honey, the girl you saw at the basketball game.
Lila favored him with an ugly smile of which he would have thought her incapable. It showed all of her teeth. Above it, her eyes, deep in their sockets now with dark brown circles beneath them, glittered.
As if you don't know, honey.
Put on your therapist's hat, he told himself. Remember that she's high on dope and running on fumes. Exhausted people can slip very easily into paranoia. But it was hard. He saw the outline of it. She thought that some girl he'd never heard of was his daughter by Shan Parks. But it was impossible. And when your wife accused you of something impossible, and everything else in the world was, by any rational standard, more important and immediate, it was very, very hard to keep from losing your temper.
Tell me what you know. Then I'll tell you what I know. But let's begin with one simple fact. That girl is not my daughter, whether she has my name or not, and I have never broken our marriage vows.
She turned as if to go back inside. He caught her by the arm. Please, tell me before you go to sleep and we lose whatever chance we have to square this, he thought. Before it can fester any more than it already has.
Lila shrugged. Does it even matter, with everything else?
His very thought a moment ago, but he could have said, it matters to you. He kept his mouth closed instead. Because in spite of all that was happening in the wider world, it mattered to him too.
You know I never even wanted this pool, don't you? Lila asked.
What?
Clint was baffled.
What did the pool have to do with anything?
Mom? Dad?
Jared was standing inside the screen door, listening. Jared, go back inside. This is between your mother and me.
No, let him listen, Lila said. If you insist on going through this, we will.
Don't you think he should know about his half-sister? She turned to Jared. She's a year younger than you. She has blonde hair, she's a talented basketball player, and she's as pretty as a picture. As you would be, if you were a girl. Because, see, she looks like you, Jer.
Dad? His brow was furrowed. What's she talking about?
Clint gave up. It was too late to do anything else.
Why don't you tell us, Lila?
Start from the beginning.
9.
Lila went through it, starting with the curriculum committee and what Dorothy Harper had said to her afterward, how she hadn't really thought much of it, but did an internet search the next day. The search had brought her to the article, which included a mention of Shannon Parks, whom Clint had spoken of once before, and a striking photograph of Sheila Norcross.
She could almost be your twin, Jared.
Jared slowly turned to his father. The three of them now sat at the kitchen table. Clint shook his head but couldn't help wondering what his face was showing, because he felt guilty, as if there had really been something to feel guilty about. It was an interesting phenomenon. That night in 2002, what he'd whispered in Shannon's ear was, "You know, I'll always be there if you need me." When she'd responded, "What if I needed you tonight?" Clint had said that was the one thing he couldn't do. If he had slept with her, there would have been something to feel guilty about, but he'd refused her, so it was all good, wasn't it? Maybe, but why had he never told Lila about the encounter? He couldn't remember, and he wasn't required to defend what happened 15 years before. She might as well demand that he explain why he'd knocked Jason down in the Bertels' backyard for nothing more than a chocolate milkshake.
Is that it? Clint asked.
He couldn't resist adding, "Tell me that's not all, Lila."
"No, that's not all," she said. "Are you going to tell me that you didn't know Shannon Parks?"
"You know I did," Clint said. "I'm sure I've mentioned her name."
"In passing," Lila said. "But it was a little more than a passing acquaintance, wasn't it?"
"Yes, it was. We were both caught in the foster system. For a while, we kept each other afloat. Otherwise, one or both of us would have drowned. It was Shannon who got me to stop fighting. She said if I didn't, I was apt to kill someone."
He took Lila's hands across the table.
"But that was years ago."
Lila pulled her hands away.
"When was the last time you saw her?"
15 years ago, Clint cried. It was ridiculous. Sheila Norcross is 15. A year younger than